The Tom Woods Show, episode 1446.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, as you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has been spreading some pretty terrible ideas, and she's wrong on just about everything. Well, I've put together the definitive smash of all of it. The Green New Deal, affordable housing so-called, free college, high tax rates. It's in another free ebook, yes, a free ebook called AOC is Wrong, The Upside Down World of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Grab your free copy at aociswrong.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I'm speaking to you from the Contra Cruise, which is still going on as I record this, obviously. And I am letting you know that today's episode is actually my appearance on a podcast called Cashflow Connections. And we're going to be talking about some important recent economic history that we have to make sure and get right. And we're going to be going into a lot of detail about it. So I hope you enjoy it. You can find out more about and subscribe to Cashflow Connections at cashflowconnections.com/podcast. Here we go.
Tom, honor to have you on. Thanks again.
My pleasure, Hunter.
So I was recently at lunch with someone that I have a lot of respect for. And I don't know them super well, but we started to talk about the economy and the state of things. And we'll talk about the details of this conversation later. But basically, the key takeaway for me was it's been a long time since 2008. And we've talked a lot about the causes of 2008. But I'm going to keep talking about it until I have to stop hearing conversations and comments made by this person, which we'll get into. But before we even get into all of that, let the listeners know, for the people that are less initiated specifically on the topic or the way that you and I think about a lot of things, provide some context as to why people that share our view of the economy had a good inkling that something significant was going to take place in the market around that time period in 2007, 2006, leading up to that.
Well, it's interesting to recall one particular person, namely at that time, Congressman Ron Paul, who in 2001 was standing on the House floor saying that as the dot-com bubble is bursting, they are revving up a real estate bubble to take its place. I mean, he just said that flat out, and he described exactly what was going to happen. So it's because folks in on our side of things are very keen on staying focused on monetary policy and seeing what the monetary authority is up to. And after with the dot-com bust, and not to mention 9/11, it seems to have been Greenspan's view that the thing to do was to try to avert recession by, or at least, again, to at least ease the conditions that people were enduring at that time, was to lower interest rates, which he did multiple times throughout 2001. And the trouble with that is manifold, but from the point of view of what later happened, what the economy was trying to do was to send red lights to people who were engaged in certain activities. Don't keep doing this anymore. But with the artificially low interest rates, all those red lights turned to green, and people persisted on paths that they should not have persisted on, whether from consumer point of view or investor point of view. They wound up doing things and continuing along paths that were not going to be sustainable for them and were going to be unwise for them in the long run. For example, that year, 2001, that was the only time on record, since records have been kept about these things, that in a recession, housing prices not only did not fall, but actually rose. That had never happened before. So that factor alone indicates something unusual is happening here. So you combine that with the fact that the economy was trying to clear out bad investments and trying to steer people in certain directions. But when the monetary authority steers them right back in, by saying we're going to pump money into the system, we're going to pump credit into the system to sustain what ought instead to have been cleared out, we know that's laying the foundation for malinvestment. Whereas other folks, I think, just get caught up in, oh, this will boost the economy. They just think in these big aggregates. This will boost the economy. This will give a shot in the arm to X or Y. But we're thinking at more of a micro level. Well, this is actually, when you combine this new money with all the various mandates coming out of the government to make loans in the housing market in particular, this is going to lead to an artificial infusion of cash into particular markets that are going to be particularly distorted. And that's what wound up happening. And you wound up seeing people doing crazy things that really don't make sense when you look at them in the sober light of day. you have people with multiple properties and, you know, and no job and no down payment, and it's an interest-only mortgage, and they just think that, because they've been told housing prices never fall, and they've been confirmed in that by what happened in 2001. Even during a recession, housing prices don't fall. So that shows that the smart money is always and forever in real estate. Well, sometimes it is, but not always and forever, and not in every circumstance. But it made the average Joe get into something where he was in over his head. In fact, I don't remember exactly who said, it might have been Joe Kennedy, who said, the way you know you got to get out of the stock market is when the local stock boy at the grocery store is giving you stock tips. Like, when everybody's in it, that's a bad sign, because everybody doesn't belong in.
Yes, and I think you mentioned malinvestment. I mean, I remember during, and not exactly necessarily in 2001, but leading up into this as we moved our way along, the definition of malinvestment pretty much was what a lot of the talking points of a lot of politicians at the time, saying necessarily, explicitly, our goal is to provide loans, to provide financing to people that otherwise wouldn't have them. And it's like, well, isn't that the definition of kind of a not a good investment? So I agree that, you know, it seemed to be the case that things started then with the interest rates. You know, I want to circle something about interest rates as well. I think a lot of people have the misconception that interest rates only apply to people that are investing in stocks or bonds or something like that. Speak to how interest rates apply to consumer goods as well. And that's a really important part of the economy, not even necessarily getting into the real estate component.
Well, the key thing for me really is the entrepreneur side of interest rates. I mean, it's true that low interest rates can in fact make consumers make bad decisions. And that is a big part of the picture, because of course, low interest rates made it seem very attractive to buy much more house than people otherwise would have. There's no question about that. And moreover, this led to a boom in the housing market to the point that people saw the rise in their housing values, and it made them feel rich, because they thought, well, at any time I can cash out of this, or I can take out a home equity loan or something. And so I can go on exotic vacations. And so you can see they make poor consumption decisions as a result of the consequences of the initially low interest rate. So the story can be told on both sides, from the investor side, because the thing with interest rates is what they're supposed to do is coordinate production across time. They're supposed to make sure that people don't engage in long-term investment at a time when nobody's saving, and you know, thereby providing the funds for long-term investment, that there's got to be some kind of a connection between the two. And the types of things people will invest in will change the lower interest rates are. If there's a project that's going to take 10 years to come to fruition and interest rates suddenly fall dramatically, well, that's going to make a big difference in your calculation, because obviously we know that, you know, a 10-year project, even if the interest rate comes down just a little bit, that really affects how much that's going to cost.
Right.
So it shifts people into longer term types of things. It's not that there's more investment. It's different types of investment, but it's types that the economy can't support, because the saving, the real saving, the deferred resources are just not there.
Yeah, it's a good point there. So let's talk then about, do you think that the interest rates, just the reduction of those interest rates, would you say that that was a leading cause of the run-up that took place in 2008? Or if not, what would be some of the leading causes of that run-up and then that collapse?
Yeah, I think you couple it with some government policy. But certainly, yeah, the low interest rates, again, they led people to false conclusions. They encouraged people to persist on unsustainable paths. And moreover, a lot of times people will talk about the poor loan quality that existed in various parts of the mortgage market in the years of the boom. And they think that this is entirely either because of banks just, you know, for whatever reason, just making poor loans, or indeed some will say that Fannie and Freddie in their various ways encouraged lower quality loans. We can get to that in a minute. But we have to bear in mind that also the monetary policy can lead to a degradation in the loan quality. And the way it would work is this. The analogy would be, if you're, remember in gym class when you were sitting in the bleachers and there were two team captains and they would pick who they wanted on your team? I remember this distinctly because I was always the kid who was picked the last. Okay, I was not the athletic type in high school. I was always picked last. So in that situation, let's imagine that each of these team captains has to pick five players. And then after they pick the five players, they're told, oh, wait a minute, you know what? For your bench, we'll let you pick three more. Well, those three more that they pick are by definition going to be worse than the five they have already because they've already chosen the best that they can get. Mm-hmm. Well, likewise with banks, at any given level of interest, they've already found all the qualified borrowers that they can find. They want to make a profit, so they lend out as much as they can lend out, and they find all the people they can find who would qualify at that interest rate. When suddenly there's an injection of credit into the economy, and now they have additional credit available, and they go back out into the market to look for more people who want to borrow, these additional people, just like the poor souls being picked for the basketball team, are going to be of lower quality than the existing ones. So this in itself is going to degrade the borrower quality. But then you combine that with the pressure being placed on lenders all along, you know, by the FHA, by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, by the Federal Reserve itself, by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which were government-supported enterprises. There's tremendous pressure to make loans that banks wouldn't have made otherwise. And then Fannie and Freddie, of course, stand ready to buy these mortgages from the banks. And whether whole mortgages or securitized, they're standing ready to buy them. Countrywide sold 90% of its mortgages to Fannie and Freddie. Fannie and Freddie existed and prospered because they had special tax and regulatory advantages from the government. And because everybody knew that if it came to that, there really would be they had a line of credit with the Treasury, but everybody knew it would be basically unlimited. It would be whatever they needed to bail them out. And that's what wound up happening. But we see even in September 2008, when Fannie and Freddie were on the verge of collapse, they were still able to borrow at just one percentage point higher than the federal government itself could borrow, which is considered to be the safest investment around. And that's because everybody assumed that, in effect, they were one and the same. They would never be allowed to hang out to dry. So you've got this tremendous pressure we see from internal emails at Fannie and Freddie to be aggressive in their activities. And they are these institutions that they'll buy these mortgages. You know, so the bank just makes them, and then they can offload them onto Fannie and Freddie. Why would you combine that with a huge amount of artificial credit poured into the system and all kinds of pressure being placed on private actors? There's no way that has a happy ending.
Certainly. I mean, when I got started down this path and learning about the history of the Great Recession, this is something that when I began to understand it, I either assumed that I was completely incorrect or that I was the only person that understood it, because it couldn't possibly be the case that other people understood this and this wasn't the most important thing that everyone was talking about. And one of the things you touched upon there is just the incentive alignment. Talk about the difference, the significant and inverted difference between incentive alignment with the GSEs or, you know, a privately owned bank, which has to cater towards profit and loss, et cetera.
Well, there is still the trouble that even the private banks have a kind of a rough sense that in a pinch they'll be bailed out, but they don't really want it. They'd prefer not to go under if they can avoid it. And of course, major financial institutions went down during the crisis, so they you know, they can't rely on that. But Fannie and Freddie more or less could. And as I say, everybody more or less knew this. This was an open secret to everyone. And so Fannie and Freddie can behave in ways that it's a case of moral hazard, that because they know they can socialize the losses. They privatize the gains. If they do really well, they're not sharing that with the taxpayer. What? But if they do really badly, the taxpayer is going to share the loss. And so it's just like the way you would treat, I'm really nice when the way I treat rental cars. But you never, ever take a rental car for an oil change, do you? It's not yours. You don't think about the long-term value of it, and the losses will be borne by somebody else. The fact that you're driving that car into the ground, you're not going to bear that loss. Somebody else will bear that loss. And so you act differently from how you would otherwise.
So I think an important part of this question, okay, so the GSEs, they have a inverted sense of incentive alignment. They're not really catering towards any particular goal that would rely on voluntary means, for example. It's a government-sponsored entity, et cetera. But how significant is this? Like, for example, paint us a picture of historically how significant of a role these GSEs played a role in the mortgage market as a whole, and then the lead up to 2005, 6, 7, 8.
Yeah. Now, my sense is that they provided this secondary market, but that it exploded in these particular years, and securitization obviously plays a role here. But I think it's also simply because the incentives are all crazily in favor of money going into the housing market. Because, as I say, banks were being told as early as the Community Reinvestment Act, which is a piece of legislation that I think some conservatives have required to bear a little bit more of the explanatory burden than it can really bear. But all the same, they made clear that if a bank wants to, let's say a bank wants to merge with another bank, they're not really going to be able to do that unless they can demonstrate that they've made certain types of loans that are considered politically desirable. So in other words, affirmative action in lending. So these are the types of pressures that are being placed on banks to make this, to be in this particular type of market. So the result of this is you get into that type of market. You know, you want to make loans like crazy. You know, you make no doc loans, so people don't even have to document basic things about themselves when it comes to income and the like, or low down payment or no down payment. Just make the loans because this is where, because we're being pressured to do it. And also because this seems to be where the money is. Everybody's telling us that housing prices never fall. So this is going to work out well. This doesn't have a sad ending. And therefore, the GSEs now, since this is, you know, the 1990s, it was the internet. It was internet stocks. In the 1920s, it was radio and other sorts of emerging technologies. There's a lot of times you can identify what was the thing. Was there one particular thing in a particular mania that was really driving it? And so in the 1990s, as I said, it was these crazy, you know, internet investments that made no sense. I mean, websites with no product, no customer, whatever, and they had these incredible valuations, it just made no sense, and yet everybody felt like they needed to do it. But in this case, you have these institutions, the GSEs, that could be like a safety valve. You can make all the loans you want, just sell them off, and just keep doing it. And so suddenly they go from being bit players to being central players in the story. And meanwhile, people, not just Barney Frank, but people across the aisle were very highly complimentary about the way these institutions were operating, were very hostile toward people who questioned the financial condition of these institutions and what might happen in the future. And so the whole thing just continues to feed on itself. And then people have trouble affording the prices of these houses. And so this leads to, you know, demands for even easier credit, so that they can afford to buy the expensive house. Instead, by the way, instead of just saying, what if we stopped all the crazy monetary expansion and the crazy programs, and we allowed prices to fall naturally? Well, when that actually happened, when the bust hit and prices fell, Barney Frank was saying prices are falling too fast. We need to stop prices from falling. So in other words, we have to prevent the arrival of affordable housing. Right. For him, affordable housing means we get you low interest loans so you can afford a really expensive house, instead of taking these supports out, letting the price of these houses fall so that you can afford them, you know, more on your own.
Well, you have to look at the political incentives as well. It's very challenging to remain in office if everyone's house is underwater. And so I think you hit the nail on the head. To typical politician, the way to affordable housing is to have everybody be able to get a great house, a really nice house that's really expensive. And that way, the two things that they want to accomplish can be accomplished. Interest rates low and houses are high.
Right, right. But meanwhile, you've ruined these people's credit histories. You know, you've ruined their credit. Some people have gone into bankruptcy. I mean, you've wrecked them financially. And there's really been no consequence for that. I mean, a lot of people's lives have been turned upside down because of this disaster. And we're supposed to look the other way because it was all done with good intentions.
Certainly. And regarding the GSEs, you know, I've seen some data on this, and going from a really relatively small piece of the market, particularly some states, 5% of the market, 8% of the market, to 50% of the market on an annualized basis. And then especially right when things were getting a little bit, they were softening pretty significantly, where the private markets had basically stopped lending, the GSEs were responsible for upwards of 90% of new mortgages being created. So basically, the private markets were just completely skeptical of everything. And because of the incentive alignment structure of the GSEs, they had no semblance of slowing down until it was absolutely too late.
Right.
Now, when I've had this conversation with people, if you take 10 people, talk to them about the causes of the Great Recession, it's very likely that some of them will mention Glass-Steagall. And I wanted to give you the opportunity to discuss why Glass-Steagall comes up in these conversations and what your thoughts are on that act and how it relates to the Great Recession, if at all.
Yeah, this one comes up mainly because, I forget which economist I was talking to about this, who said, the reason it comes up, even though it is not related to the crisis, is that people are searching around for something that at least sounds like it might have some connection to it. Like they feel almost with a religious faith that there must have been some regulation that could have prevented this. And therefore, they look for something that has certain words in the description. They say, aha, so if only our wise overlords hadn't repealed this, we could have been saved from it. Well, all right. Well, what exactly was it? First of all, it's worth noting that Europe never had anything like Glass-Steagall. Never. And they've done reasonably well. They haven't suffered for lack of it. So that's worth noting. Glass-Steagall goes all the way back to 1933. And the purpose of it was to build a wall between commercial banking and investment banking. So it prohibits banks from underwriting or dealing in securities, apart from, you know, basically riskless government issues or government-backed securities. Now, so the prohibition on dealing in securities, what that means is banks couldn't acquire securities for the purpose of selling them, but they could acquire them to hold because they think they're good investments. And then if they want to sell them later because they don't think they're good investments anymore, or just because they need cash, they could do that. Second, securities firms, likewise, could not take deposits. And then the other two provisions of Glass-Steagall prevented banks from affiliating with firms whose main function was to underwrite or deal in securities. So what happens then in the 1990s is you get what's called the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, and people think that this repeals Glass-Steagall. It does not. It repeals only this last part. So that means that from now on, it's now possible for a commercial bank and an investment bank to coexist under the umbrella of a single holding company. That is the change. So the question is, does this change account for the crisis? And it's interesting to note, I read a couple of articles in, of all places, the Washington Post, that came out and said, look, let's be honest. I know we're all looking for some regulatory boogeyman here, but let's be honest. The partial repeal of Glass-Steagall has nothing to do with the crisis. So even the Washington Post pointed out that three of the institutions that were really at the heart of the crisis, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, and Merrill Lynch, these were pure investment banks.
Right.
They never crossed any line into commercial banking. Same goes for Goldman Sachs. AIG was an insurance firm.
Completely unrelated.
Right. New Century Financial is a real estate investment trust. No Glass-Steagall in that case. Wachovia and Washington Mutual were two of the biggest banks that went under, but they went under the old-fashioned way. They had made risky loans to homeowners. And Bank of America almost met that fate, but not because it bought an investment bank, but because it bought Countrywide Financial, which was a mortgage lender. So the point is, if you're going to try to say this is the cause of it, I think that's a smokescreen. I think people are throwing that term around because they assume most listeners won't know what it is. And it sounds pretty sophisticated. Glass-Steagall, I don't even know what that is. And it sounds like, I mean, it sounds plausible that, yeah, the government could have stopped this with wise regulatory oversight. And so I think people are inclined to think that. But I think it is a complete red herring. I don't see the connection.
Well, I mean, in the conversations that people have now going forward, this is frequently, when it comes up in my conversations, it's basically that's the extent of the argument. It's, oh, do you not know about Glass-Steagall? It's like, yes, I do. What do you think about it? And it's like, that's the end of it. Like the stating the name Glass-Steagall or the quote repealing
right.
of Glass-Steagall, it's like, yeah, that's the end
yeah,
all be all.
It's like, hey, look over there. And they want to run away.
You know? Yeah. Well, similarly, there may be 3 people out of 10 that may mention Glass-Steagall in terms of the cause of the recession. If you have 10 people and you're talking about the cause of the recession, there may be none that mention the Federal Reserve. And it is the very entity, this whole conversation has really been about interest rates. It's a very entity which controls interest rates and the entire currency. It's pretty much a matter of fact that if anything significant happens in the economy, if it's significant, an entity like that should be part of the conversation, in my opinion. So what is your perspective on the Fed? We've talked about, you know, the reduction of interest rates earlier, but even more so, maybe even the lead up and then the aftermath as well.
Well, we have hit on some of this. So I'll say that another interesting factor about all this is that the Fed, one of its functions is it is supposed to be the primary regulator of the banks. So we naturally tend to look to it to hear what's going on in the economy, what the Fed's plans are. And it became a running joke after the bust to go back and listen to what Greenspan and Bernanke had been saying about the market. And funny, just even to read in Greenspan's own memoir, that he said he knew that banks were going to be taking riskier mortgages into their portfolios, but that it was, he thought, worth the risk. Well, I'm glad doesn't hurt him in any way. It's easy for him to say that it's worth the risk. But he just said, yeah, we thought it was worth giving a shot. But the worst really was Ben Bernanke, because every aspect of that question he got wrong. I mean, every aspect of it. The subprime isn't going to spill over. Problems aren't going to spill over anywhere else. Economy looks robust. Lending standards are robust. Over and over. I mean, just things that you wonder, there's no way he could possibly believe these things. Or is he saying them just to try to stabilize markets? You know, you even find yourself going down that rabbit hole. Is he saying things he knows to be false, you know, just to stabilize markets? And then there is the fact that the very existence of a central bank that has these monopoly privileges on the issuance of credit, that the very existence of that thing tends to encourage, creates moral hazard, because you know that it's just a matter of political will to get you bailed out. It's not a matter of, well, there isn't enough gold to bail you out. It's just a matter of political will to bail out actors. And people were still operating under the presumption of the so-called Greenspan put. When Greenspan arranged for the bailout of long-term capital management in 1998, people took this to mean that there was a floor beneath which Greenspan would not allow markets to go. And so he would be there in a pinch to make sure things went smoothly. So there are all these factors surrounding the Fed. I mean, it's, you know, the interest rate thing, you could go on and on forever about the damage that artificially low interest rates cause. But you combine that with moral hazard, with also the sense that there's some wise regulator overseeing everything. I mean, the Federal Reserve is the wise regulator. And so, you know, if things were really bad, they'd tell us. It's that kind of thing.
Certainly.
And not to mention, on the state and local level, on the eve of the crisis, there were 115 agencies whose task it was, in one way or another, to regulate the financial sector. There was no shortage of regulation. There was no shortage of regulators. There was no shortage of spending on financial regulation. The spending on it had tripled in real terms, adjusting for inflation, since 1980. So all the kinds of explanations people might want to come up with for why this happened and it was a lack of oversight, you have to be kidding me. There's no lack of oversight here.
I mean, 115 regulatory agencies specifically designed to regulate the financial sector, with thousands of employees and hundreds of millions of dollars of a budget and just offices all around the country. But man, if we just had one more, if we just had just
well,
a little
116. Yeah,
that's
that
right. That's right. Just a little bit more of the budget, then we would have been able to solve this whole problem. We could have gotten ahead of it this time. And then, of course, since then, nothing has changed. We have had very much of the same. I think that, you know, one of the things I want to talk to you about is the bailouts, which you talked about in your book as well. This is one of the reasons I want to have you on, because in a lot of circles, this is essentially a necessary evil that took place. And this is what I had a conversation about. This is someone, like I mentioned, a lot of respect for this person, very smart guy, attorney, investor, you know, all the cool things that we like to talk about in the real estate sector we're talking about. And one of the things he mentioned was, you know, if the Fed hadn't taken action and provided those bailouts and provided that liquidity in the market, we would likely be facing a 20-year recession. And that was something that he said with confidence. And I was really hesitant to kind of engage in that kind of conversation because it just requires a lot of explaining. But what do you think? Number one, what do you think what would happen if those bailouts didn't take place?
All right. Well, I don't think the world would have ended, and I think I've got good reason for thinking that. I mean, let me first describe what I think was actually going on in the economy. I do have a book called Meltdown on this subject, and the paperback edition didn't come out till 10 years later. It came out just 9 or 10 years later, just the end of last year, because the hardcover just kept selling. So they thought, why? And I wanted them to do a paperback, make it cheaper on the poor folks. So I wrote a new foreword and kind of bring the story up to date. And so I went back and re-examined a lot of these questions and how well I feel like my explanations held up over time. And I thought, this is my favorite book ever. I have nothing to change. Everything's exactly as I said. So what was happening basically after the dot-com bust, you know, as I've said, Greenspan wants to stimulate the economy. And household debt winds up doubling in less than 7 years. It's growing at the absurd rate of 10.2% a year. That's not a trend that's going to be able to continue in perpetuity. So what's happening is that by 2008, that process is beginning to slow down and even reverse itself. So on a one-time basis, elective spending on non-necessities like vacations or home renovations or things like that, those were being brought down to a level that made sense in terms of what people's earnings were. That did not mean that the economy was spiraling down into a black hole and that, you know, only the Fed's interventions were going to be able to rescue it. It meant that those sectors of the economy that had developed and expanded only because of cheap credit from the Fed and that could not be sustained with people's real earnings, those sectors were shrinking and resources were being shifted into lines of production that would be sustainable over the long term. And that's really how an economy heals itself after its central bank pumps it with, you know, the equivalent of energy drinks nonstop for 7 years. But what we got was this myth that Great Depression 2.0 was on our heels. And so we've got to shovel money to irresponsible firms as quickly as possible. We don't have time to go over the details with you, citizen.
Sure.
We need to do this. So for example, AIG, that's where a lot of our attention was focused early in the crisis. We were told that the credit default swap problem was going to lead to a too big to fail situation because the counterparties were all going to collapse and all that. But we were also told that we have to save Wall Street in order to save Main Street. But that was just flat out not true because almost none of AIG's CDS liabilities were held by Main Street banks. They were held by about a dozen large institutions. And those institutions that held those busted CDS liabilities would have taken the hit. And we know they could have absorbed that hit because these institutions held about $20 trillion in assets. And what were they facing in losses? $60 billion, maybe $80 billion? That's about a year's worth of executive bonuses. You know, that's not exactly the end of the world. AIG wound up getting its bailout anyway. But lo and behold, April 2009, we get the CEO of AIG, Maurice Greenberg, saying to Congress that, you know, on second thought, AIG should have been just allowed to go through the bankruptcy process and that the economic effects would have been trivial. The public would have been spared the bailout. Now, that's interesting because that's what people like me were saying, and we were all crazy idiots. And then he himself said it. And we can, again, we could just look at the actual consequences. We look at Lehman Brothers. Lehman was not bailed out. It was allowed to go under, as you recall. Well, even their credit default swap obligations did not cause any substantial disruption in the CDS market. And all of the CDSs specifically written on Lehman were just settled through the exchange of about $6 billion among hundreds of counterparties. And there was no known insolvency that was created among any of these counterparties that were protected by a Lehman CDS. So again, this is a crying wolf situation, but most people don't know anything about this. What in heaven's name is a credit default swap? They have no idea what's going on, and all the respectable people are telling them we've got to shovel money into these firms. And then, not to mention, of course, there were also the auto bailouts, and we're told, well, of course, we have to save, you know, American automobile manufacturing. But there, the misleading part of that is the idea that if a firm goes through bankruptcy, that the firm disappears or something. But of course, it doesn't. All it means is that you redistribute the assets to other owners, and then you just continue as before. Well, who cares if there are new owners? There should be new owners. Why would you want to reward people who have such awful results? I mean, I can't remember exactly what the figure was for GM, but the amount of money they were losing per car was astonishing. And why would you want to keep management in place there, ownership in place that had presided over an outcome like that? You want to shift those resources into other hands, or otherwise you are rewarding failure. I mean, it's just like in anything else in life or in the economy. You don't want to reward failure because what kind of entrepreneur, what quality of entrepreneur is encouraged in that type of economy? In fact, I was just mentioning the other day, there's a very interesting article by an economist at Kent State University named Lucas Engelhardt. And he did a paper on what happens when the Fed lowers interest rates artificially. He says it's not, because you might say, well, why aren't investors smart enough to know, all right, well, these interest rates are kind of fake, and so we shouldn't get taken in by them and, you know, wind up making dumb decisions that come back to bite us. And he says it's not that entrepreneurs become stupid. It's that the stupid become entrepreneurs. And in that kind of situation where it's like a big casino and money is just sloshing around,
right,
that's when the shysters and the idiots all flock in. And so I feel like the bailouts are the type of thing that reward that kind of entrepreneur. And that's the kind, qualitatively, the kind we don't want.
Folks, let's take a second for me to let you in on one of my secrets. We all know we have way too much to read. We can't possibly get to it all. One way that I cope with that is an amazing app called Blinkist. It takes the best key takeaways, all the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and condenses them down to just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. And frankly, there are a lot of books that you really need to spend only 15 minutes with. But those 15 minutes can be gold. I like Blinkist because in a 30-minute round trip, I can have done the equivalent of reading 4 books. I have 5 daughters and I'm always carting them somewhere. So in between that, when I'm going to pick them up and stuff, I'm listening to Blinkist. So I've used Blinkist to listen to classic books like The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And also there's a great book called Factfulness, 10 Reasons We're Wrong About the World and Why Things Are Better Than You Think, that I think will resonate very nicely with libertarians. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial. Blinkist.com/woods.
When things go wrong, it doesn't matter how significant it is. It doesn't really change the fact that people are still like out and to work for their best interest. So if a company goes under, the people don't just go home and play video games until they starve to death. They will find something to do productive to bring in income to their house. Like you mentioned, the firm doesn't disappear. It means that someone else gets those resources, someone buys them out, et cetera. And it's most likely someone buying them out, which has the capital to do so because of the fact that they were better operators than the other person. So maybe those people that made that mistake should get a new job. I mean, it's not heartless to say that if you ran a company into the ground, that you should maybe find another line of work. So
yeah, or if it's, I mean, because that's true in all different situations. Like maybe you're producing something nobody wants anymore. Tastes have changed.
Yes.
Are you entitled to continue producing something that is of no social benefit? I mean, that would be extremely antisocial to think that. You have to
adapt. I think it's the worst. No, I think that's the worst.
Yeah.
Yeah, the syndicalist type of thing where the thing is focused on the producer as opposed to the consumer. As it's like, we have to keep the horse and buggy operators in business because what are they going to do if they lose their jobs? I think that is pretty much the worst philosophy that can be taken. It leads to total primitivism. That's it's the absolute worst. We won't have to go down that route. But I do want to give the opportunity to talk about something which I learned a lot in one of your discussions because of the fact that regarding this 20-year depression that my friend was anticipating, there is some historical things that we can look at regarding recessions, which have been pretty significant, but also relatively short-lived. So I wanted to talk to you about the recession, the forgotten recession, as it's called, of 1920. Tell us a bit about that and what's so interesting about it.
Well, what's interesting about that is that you actually had a bigger monetary contraction in 1 year than you had at any 1 year period during the Great Depression. You had double-digit unemployment, a big fall in production. I mean, the numbers were terrible. And by the time, because at that time you had Woodrow Wilson leaving, he was almost incapacitated at that time. His wife was more or less running the country. And then by 1921, you have Warren Harding, who was inclined to be hands-off with the economy, but he had that, Budinsky, Herbert Hoover as his commerce secretary. Herbert Hoover has this false reputation for being a free market, laissez-faire guy. He was constantly wanting to tinker. And he had this big plan for spending on public works. And by the time they were thinking about implementing it, the recession was already over. And the Federal Reserve did not engage in open market operations. It did bring the discount rate down a bit, but that was after the recovery was already happening. And they lowered spending, which you're not supposed to do, but they did. They dramatically lowered spending and lowered taxes. And the result was pretty impressive. They turned it around in about, considering how screwed up the economy had been because of all the dislocations of World War I, they were able to turn around about a year and a half. And Joseph Schumpeter, one of the great 20th century economists, said that this episode alone shows you that the economy turns itself around under its own steam. Now, there have been attempts by Keynesians to try to debunk my version of events here, but all those attempts fail because they all get the timeline wrong and we've all written papers responding to them. But the point is that you had a recession where the government did not engage in fiscal stimulus. The government did not engage in monetary stimulus. Nobody knew what those things even were. Nobody used that language at that time. And you get this result. Meanwhile, in the Great Depression, you have an unprecedented amount of government intervention. And yet the thing persists year after year after year. I mean, in 1939, the unemployment rate is approaching 20% after all that. Now, it's true that maybe you could at least plausibly argue that maybe the government should have done even more and they just weren't doing enough. But could you imagine if the cases were reversed and in 1920 to 21, the government had intervened like crazy and it had ended quickly? And then in the Great Depression, they had done nothing and it went on for year after year after year. You think the other side might make hay out of that? You know, they'd be telling us all day long, well, you see, we had the quick recession of 1920 when the government got involved. And then when you stupid laissez-faire people got involved in the Great Depression, it just persisted. Of course they'd say that. But when it's reversed, it's total silence to the point where most Americans don't even know there was a 1920 to 21 recession.
Oh, right. No, it's much worse than the discussion. It's much worse than the argument. It's the forgotten recession of 1920. So there is no time for that argument. There is no place. There is no space for that discussion to be had because it's just not part of the discussion. So pretty remarkable. But I appreciate going to that detail there. So I live in Los Angeles, California, and there's a lot of different ways to track the economy and track incomes and track housing prices. We are, at least in residential real estate, I can say with a high degree of confidence that we are not in bubble territory. In fact, we are, just to summarize really quickly, the affordability index is something that Bruce Norris uses. A lot of listeners are familiar with. The lower the affordability, which is the percentage of people that can pay a mortgage with 20% down, the lower the affordability, higher prices. It's an inverse correlation. Typically, California has peaked out at 17% affordability, meaning only 17% of people can afford to pay a mortgage. We are nowhere near 17%. We're somewhere in the 26% range, which on a historical basis is not really that significant. And it looks like things are just kind of going slow and steady and really unlike what we've seen in the past with California, which is extremely volatile. And I was commenting about this to someone and they said, well, you can thank Dodd-Frank for that because it's created all the stability in the lending market, which has allowed things not to go so crazy. I wanted to hear your thoughts on that and how you would respond to someone who holds that viewpoint.
Well, you would know California specifically better than I would, but just with regard to Dodd-Frank, I would speak just generally about what its effects have been.
Sure.
And here I would refer to the work of Peter Wallison at the American Enterprise Institute. He's written a whole book on Dodd-Frank. It is a gigantic book in which he documents what it's actually accomplished. And his view is that it's just been negative, because he says the compliance costs are so absurd that it just crushes community banks. And he says, look at the trend of how many banks were opened per year before Dodd-Frank and then after. Before Dodd-Frank, it was about 100 per year. After Dodd-Frank, it was 3. I mean, it's not like it went down 10%. I mean, that's an unbelievable thing.
It's a catastrophic 97% decrease.
Right. So when you consider that obviously big business, they can raise funds in the capital markets. But when you consider that small business, they rely on these local community banks for a lot of their credit. And when these banks are not, you know, they're not expanding to the degree that you would need them in a growing economy and growing population, this puts a squeeze on small business and it harms them and has had harmful economic effects. So Wallison documents this pretty thoroughly. And I hadn't even heard this argument before. And then I talked to him and I walked away completely convinced.
Yeah, it's the lack of the new banks is pretty remarkable. I was actually at a Mises Institute, which you spoke at, which Naomi Prinz mentioned that, and it's pretty shocking there. So I know that we're coming up on our time, and I want to be respectful of that. And I have got a million questions to ask you, but I'll keep it simple. One of the things that is so present in this conversation, which is that we live in a society and an economy that is to a large degree centrally planned, particularly as relates to the monetary policy. And that can have a little bit of a negative impact on your psyche. You feel like, what's the point? There's just this massive Federal Reserve that has its tentacles in everything that I do. And maybe there's a lot of people out there that are focusing on jobs they shouldn't be focusing on because the interest rates are low and therefore they're pursuing this and la, la, la. I was wondering if you could talk to some people that hold our worldview in terms of how to stay positive in that environment, how to focus on being an entrepreneur, just something in terms of how to get away from being a curmudgeon, basically, because no one really likes that. And it's the last way to influence people in terms of getting them to see your worldview?
Well, I would recommend that they read How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World by Harry Brown, because he reminds us that not all of life is politics. And my gosh, you get one shot at it, you know, on this earth.
Sure.
And if you spent all of it upset about the Fed's intervening in interest rates, then the terrorists have won. We'll put it that way. So, I mean, I'm not in real estate and I'm not involved in anything that would be affected really any substantial way by monetary policy. But to me, I feel like we are nevertheless living in a time when, you know, not hugely, but more than ever before, there is a narrative out there that is anti-central bank. You know, I think we have Ron Paul to thank for that.
Agreed.
And that is encouraging. There was who on the three television networks was saying anything critical about the central bank in 1965? You know, that was not happening at all. But some of our folks, you know, get on television and talk about it. I mean, Jim Grant is a major figure. And I mean, I could list a whole bunch of people who gives our explanation of things very, very effectively. So, yeah, we're not making crazy, insane progress, but the trend is upward. And as I say, there, you know, for me, the way I've handled it is I generally am not doing a lot of the things that would expose me to that kind of risk. But even if I were, I would just listen to people I know have got a good track record, people I know I can trust. I would read, you know, Grant's Interest Rate Observer, for example, because I think Jim Grant is very knowledgeable. He's somebody I would absolutely trust. So I would basically look for people to guide me through it in the same way that when I was a Harvard undergraduate, there are some professors at Harvard who are just flat out propagandists. But for the most part, once you get to that level, a lot of the nonsense slips away. These are really serious people who take their disciplines seriously, but you have to know who's who. And who guided me through that? Well, I went to students who thought the way I did, who'd been around for a long time, who could name names, and they helped guide me through. And so I would look to reliable people, and I'm sure you can recommend to your listeners people you think would be reliable to listen to. But yeah, becoming a curmudgeon, that's a choice. I mean, I feel like there's so many bad things going on. But on the other hand, there are tremendous good things. And I know that there's been some problems about cracking down on free speech on the internet. But I feel like in the grand scheme of time, that's a blip. That's a blip because technology is going to overcome that one way or another. And we live at a time when you can write a book and it can be instantaneously read by anyone in the world. That's a liberating time to be alive. And we get so caught up in the negative that we forget about that. We forget about the fact that the state is, at least in the U.S. and probably a lot of European countries, is highly constrained right now. Because even though the Democrats have lots of plans for what they're going to do with this and that, how are they going to implement them? The money does not exist. It's going to just be a lot more gridlock for a while. So things are not as bad as they seem. And then just think about your kids and your hobbies and the things you love and enjoy those things and don't let the bastards get you down.
Yeah, I like that. And I can even say that regarding, you know, the news and the media and what people are saying, I think a lot of people have the impression that we're living in this time of fake news and the mainstream media is fake news. There has never been a time to more easily access accurate information in the history of the world than right now. There is a complete disruption that's taking place in which you can find alternative viewpoints to the mainstream, so much so that I don't even know that the mainstream is the mainstream anymore, given what I think is most influential in terms of the circles that I'm in. And that's really incredible. And something else that happened on the show recently, there was a guest who was on the program who works with centimillionaires and billionaires. And one of the things he mentioned when I started talking about kind of the shifting dynamics in terms of the political dynamics of the United States, he said, listen, yes, that is taking place, but all of the wealthy billionaires and centimillionaires in the world, most of them want their children to go to college here because they want to learn from us in the culture that we have in the United States. And I thought that was really, really empowering and also just made me feel very lucky that where I was born into the culture that I was born into. So I think that's, you know, something else I wanted to add to that. So Tom, before we jump off, let the listeners know how they can learn more about you, obviously link to some of your books and, you know, learn more about your show as well.
Well, the best thing to do actually is to get, I have a free ebook that deals with this question of did deregulation cause the financial crisis? It's very important for us to get this because everybody disagrees with us, but we're so right about this. So I actually wrote a free ebook called The Deregulation Boogeyman. And I highly recommend it to people who are listening to us right now. So you can get that at regulationmyths.com. And then once you do that, you know, you'll see a link for how you could listen to my show and stuff. But do that first, because you will be glad you read that thing. regulationmyths.com.
Awesome. Well, we will link to that in the show notes page. Tom, can't thank you enough. Thanks again.
My pleasure.
All right, folks, remember, it is almost the next academic year, and some of you homeschooling folks are thinking about what you're going to be doing. And if you are considering the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, remember that if you subscribe to it through me, you get really great bonuses. You get a subscription to my Liberty Classroom, you get a special course just for you, and you get an autographed copy of The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. These are great bonuses only available through me and available only through ronpaulhomeschool.com. That's my special link, ronpaulhomeschool.com, and then you get those bonuses. So go check that out. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.